Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
His visit to Baghdad, President Bush held a press conference in the Rose Garden today. He had a message for terrorists and critics of the war in Iraq. Don't count on the United States to leave Iraq before the mission there is done. But he said he understood why voters might be concerned.
And I understand how tough it is for the American people to reconcile death on their TV screens with the president saying we're making incremental progress toward an important goal. But what I hope they understand is how important it is we succeed in Iraq.
Well, joining us on the line from Washington is Los Angeles Times White House correspondent Peter Walston. And Peter, the president was asked about whether the U.S. would stay there until there was zero violence in the country or whether there would be a time period set for measuring success there. What did he say? What did he say would determine success in Iraq?
Well, of course, he's pretty vague about that, but he's kind of purposefully becoming more vague almost on the issue. He seems to recognize that that earlier attempts to say, for instance, as he once did, you know, the tide has turned in Iraq, or the tide is turning, things are changing, everything's improving. He seems to realize that that begins to ring hollow when violence continues. So now he seems to be taking a different course, and today he made it clear repeatedly that he understands that you can't just expect zero violence right away, that you can't just expect fast a quick change or a quick fix.
Well, and he also talked about reestablishing the Iraqi government, electricity and oil infrastructure. He said we've got to be realistic about what can be done. This as, you know, the Iraqi prime minister is cracking down on security in Baghdad with increased road checks and a lot of, you know, troops pouring into that area. So what do you read from this?
Well, in many ways, it's more of the same. I mean, what's different here really, in a way, is staging. I guess I don't want to misuse the word theatrics, but what's happened is the White House is really trying to seize on the idea that there's a new government in Iraq, and they are now changing kind of the staging of the way that they talk about this. Mm-hmm. The president went there. Of course, that was a trip that the White House arranged. Now, he held this press conference today and talked a lot about his view of the situation. That doesn't mean that the situation has changed that much. It just really means that he's changing the way he's talking about it. And, of course, it's an election year, and Republicans are worried that the war could become a drag on their ability to retain control of Congress. And what we saw today, actually, and the president talked a little bit about the Democrats and how the Democrats don't have a coherent view, at least as a group, on what to do in Iraq, that he feels, and the White House feels, that this issue could actually work in the favor of Republicans in the election.
Well, I was going to ask you that, because the tone at the press conference seemed buoyant. The president was joking with reporters. He chided you for your sunglasses, and yet not a particularly new message. You're saying it's being staged in a different way. Are you getting the sense from the administration that they feel that they're at some sort of turning point?
Well, I think that they are at a turning point in terms of domestic, the selling of the war in terms of domestic U.S. politics. I can't speak to whether there's a turning point on the ground in Iraq. It seems like, from what I hear from my colleagues over there and from what we report, that there's not much of a turning point in terms of the violence and the stability of that government. You know, it's interesting that the president actually traveled there, and certainly they made a big show of him going, but they were so concerned about the danger and security in Iraq that they didn't even tell the prime minister of the country that he was coming. They surprised the leader of that country. So that says something. But I do think there's a bit of a turning point here in the way that the White House is now going a bit on the offensive in terms of domestic U.S. politics to not necessarily sell the war to the public as they used to try to do, but now to really compare their approach of trying to win the war versus how they portray the Democrats of trying to, as they say, quote, cut and run.
And some would say the Democrats are helping them out a bit because, as you know, they're having their own internal debate. Not everyone in the party is united on the idea of whether or not to have an immediate pullout of troops, and it would seem as if the president was perhaps reacting to that today.
Yes, he certainly didn't mind the fact that one reporter brought up the fact that Hillary Clinton was booed when she refused to give a timetable, but booed by liberal activists this week when she didn't want to give a timetable, and Senator Kerry came out and said that he regretted his vote for the war. You know, these are the kinds of it's that kind of debate that a lot of Republicans feel. You know, they can kind of bet the farm on in this election, that they feel that as long as the Democrats can be painted as lacking a coherent strategy or view on what to do in Iraq, that that the Republicans can succeed politically.
And of course, as we know, that debate is going to continue in Congress tomorrow, the debate on troop withdrawal. Peter Walston, White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, after today's presidential press conference in the Rose Garden. Peter, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Well, now a close look at another campaign to save lives in hospitals, or should we say, save lives from hospital care. By some estimates, as many as 98,000 Americans die each year after going to the hospital from problems that arise after they're admitted, problems such as pneumonia or infection. But a campaign to prevent medical mistakes and save lives claims to be making a significant dent in that number. Dr. Donald Berwick is president of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. In 2004, they pledged to save 100,000 lives in hospitals by today. They're announcing the results in Atlanta. And before we hear those results, Dr. Berwick, this campaign involves some pretty simple concepts now being employed at thousands of hospitals because of your campaign. So first, tell us some of the things that are happening. Lay out your six-point prescription plan to ensure that healthcare really helps.
The first of those is to institute rapid response teams. I think people generally know that there are code call teams that respond when a patient's heart stops, but it turns out that a lot of early warning signs exist, and if you can send essentially a code call team to a bedside simply when a nurse gets worried about a patient, you can prevent a large number of cardiac arrests and actually save a surprisingly large number of lives.
And part of that is to train patients visiting family members to call when they need help.
That was introduced by several hospitals who decided to give the authority to call the rapid response teams, not just to the nurses and the staff, but to the patients and the families. And it's a tremendous innovation. It appears to have substantial effect.
For instance, Australian researchers, we read, using rapid response teams may be able to cut hospital death rates by 20%.
The original reports were even higher than 20%. I don't think all hospitals get that kind of result, but we're seeing double-digit changes in death rates just with the institution of rapid response.
I can just hear listeners saying, you know, you're saying that you got to get a rapid response team when you feel that there's trouble. I can't get, a nurse or a doctor to come down the hall when I think there's trouble. How do you leap in sometimes overburdened hospitals from getting anyone to come help to get a rapid response team?
Well, that's sort of the nature of the problem. Everyone in the hospital is working very hard. They're doing the best. Unless you establish a stable system that can respond quickly, just trying harder won't do the job. So just like we need a code call team to respond when the heart stops, if we set up a special process so people can respond urgently to a worried nurse, it can be executed well by the hospital. You have to have a system in place. That's the point. This isn't about asking the doctors and nurses to try harder. It's giving them a system that allows response to occur.
Okay, well, let's move on. Point number two.
Point number two is to increase the reliability of care for heart attacks, a very common cause of serious disease and death in hospitals. We know what to do for heart attacks. You can find it on the website of the American College of Cardiology or the American Heart Association, but we don't always do it. Reliability rates are up in the 80 or 90% range for individual elements. We're asking hospitals to complete a total bundle of care for heart attack victims with simple interventions like giving aspirin when they arrive, using beta blocker medications when they're called for. And that level of reliability can cut heart attack death rates substantially by a quarter or a half.
I read the other part of that recommendation is a patient should get a stent or clot buster promptly after admission. In other words, not sitting on the gurney in the hall.
Yeah, that's probably the hardest one to execute, to have flow set up in the hospital just right so we can get that stent in and get the blood flow back to the heart muscle reestablished very, very quickly. And it's now shown from research that the sooner we do that, the less muscle is damaged. Mm. And the higher the survival rates.
And we see that McLeod Regional Medical Center in Florence, South Carolina, cut the death rate there among heart attack patients from 10%, which is, as you write, about the average in the U.S., to 4%.
Yes, we've seen hospital after hospital cut their death rates by a quarter or a half of where they started. So there's quite a bit of gain to be made.
Okay, next point.
The next point is to avoid certain kinds of medication errors, especially those that occur in transitions. Patients get injured and sometimes they die from errors in medication when they move from one location to another. So a relatively simple process we call medication reconciliation and a few other things can cut the rate of such medication errors quite dramatically, reducing fragmentation.
Fragmentation?
Fragmentation means the different parts of the system don't coordinate very well. So a patient's in the intensive care unit on some medicine, goes out to the hospital floor and is supposed to get that medicine, but there's a mistake made at the transition point. It's a handoff problem, and we can fix it.
And one of the systems you recommend is that a protocol assigns a doctor or nurse at every step of the transfer to check and recheck. In other words, their job is to make sure that the medication plan follows the patient.
Yeah, it's not a complicated job, but it's an important job, and we just didn't wire it into most systems. Now we will, and having coordination across boundaries is extremely important.
Okay, let's hear another point.
Well, the three other interventions are all about preventing infections that people get in hospitals. Infections are killers, especially when people are frail or elderly or recovering from surgery. And so the first of the infections has to do with infections of catheters that are put into the veins of sick people to feed them or to give them medication, central venous lines. These can get bacterial infections, and those are highly lethal, and yet they can be prevented. I personally think they can be eliminated.
How? What is the recommendation?
It's actually relatively simple. On the Centers for Disease Control has standards for the proper care of these intravenous lines using hand washing techniques, the appropriate preparation of the site, monitoring the catheter site, changing it at the appropriate intervals but not too frequently. And these relatively simple processes, if they're made absolutely reliable, can drive central line infections close to zero. In fact, to zero in some hospitals.
Well, you know, but again, you're talking about something that seems so simple. The washing of the hands is recommended for stopping all of the three infections that you talk about. But, for instance, making sure that the catheter doesn't remain in a vein even 1 hour longer than needed, that goes back to, you know, overwhelmed nurses.
We're hearing nurses tell us that when things go better, when the rapid response team responds or when the patient does not get an infection, well, the load on the nursing and other staff decreases. And so it's a way to find the time that people need to actually focus on taking care of patients. Mm-hmm. Defects don't just hurt patients. They hurt the capability of the staff to do what patients need. Mm-hmm. So I think these campaign interventions are not time sinks. They're time savers. And that's an important change in understanding how to free up the time of nurses and doctors and others.
Well, the other two points where you feel you can prevent death or injury is stopping surgical site infections and preventing respirator pneumonia.
If we buckle down and follow exactly the procedures that are designated by the Centers for Disease Control and the Society for Critical Care Medicine and others and make sure that every single patient gets everything done for them, simple things, we can eliminate ventilator pneumonias. We have over two dozen hospitals listed on the Institute for Healthcare Improvement website that have had no ventilator pneumonias in a year or more.
By doing things as simple as raising the head of the hospital bed of a patient on a ventilator, or, we read in your report, using scissors to trim hair during preparation for surgery instead of a razor because scissors don't nick the skin as a razor does and a razor causes infections. We're speaking with Dr. Don Berwick, president of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, working with thousands of hospitals to reduce medical errors and therefore fatalities. Well, after a break, we'll find out how many lives Dr. Berwick says the campaign is saving. Prepare to be amazed. Much more coming up here and now. Healthcare Improvement, their goal, to reduce medical mistakes in hospitals by taking simple steps such as raising the head of a hospital bed to reduce respirator pneumonia. Dr. Berwick, when you started this 100,000 lives campaign back in 2004, you set today as the deadline to save that many lives. So how many lives do you think have been saved?
It's an estimate. We have to collect data from hospitals, put it all together, crank it through some statistical models that involve adjusting for the severity of patients and the volume of admissions, but we have a number. And our best guess in the first 18 months of this effort is that in this nation we've had a reduction of deaths by 122,300 patients.
Wow.
That's our best guess. We've exceeded our goal, and it just amazes me.
You know, that is both stunning and you know, to be congratulated, and it's also heartbreaking, you know, to think that last year, perhaps over 100,000 lives were lost because people didn't raise the head of a bed, you know, if somebody was on a ventilator, or have a rapid response team when a patient, you know, when a family member thought something was wrong. I mean, these are such simple things.
They are simple things, but the cultural change and the focus on making things better is a hard transition for people to make. You know, I'm inspired by what I'm seeing. You could have seen a healthcare system that just was too afraid to say we have problems, backing off, basically recognizing the reality that these are defects in our care. And so we can, join together in some kind of sorrow that we haven't acted sooner. But I am really energized and tremendously optimistic by the outpouring now of energy in the system to do something about it. You don't improve unless you begin by facing reality. We've done that. It's taken courage, and now we're seeing people get about the job of doing what they went to work always to do, which is to take care of the patient well.
Well, let's examine the numbers just a little bit. Okay. 122,000 lives saved. Now, what do you mean by saved?
The definition of a life saved in the campaign is very particular. It means it's a patient who would have died during a hospitalization who we think did not die because of improvements in care. We're comparing death rates in the year 2004 to the campaign interval in 2005 and 2006. So this means you got out of the hospital alive when otherwise you would have died.
How do you determine that someone who died 2 years ago, because it wasn't that there was an error, it's that they were so weak that they were going to get pneumonia because they were on the ventilator, not because somebody made a mistake by lowering their head when they were on the ventilator. Do you understand what I'm saying? How do you know? So how do you know that somebody is alive today because somebody took better care of the ventilator?
It's very hard to know that any specific individual patient is alive today to point to that person and say they're alive because of a campaign-level intervention, for example. Sometimes we know a patient was saved by a rapid response team and we know the story, but for others of these are statistical lives saved and we can't identify the person. But we can watch the patterns. We can watch hospitals through time change the death rates that we can measure, adjusted for severity, and attribute a real improvement to that hospital's care in terms of people that just didn't die.
Right.
Some of the deaths, of course, that we're averting are of people who are very, very sick and who will, frankly, die soon, perhaps, of their disease or something that their care can't change. And so it's important to understand we're not professing to that people get immortal through the campaign. We're saying that people won't die before their time. And so even a cancer patient who's going to die next week of their cancer won't die this week of a ventilator pneumonia. We're trying to do everything we can, even though in the end, of course, we're all mortal.
Right. But you can see, bottom line, you can see a hospital, you know, 2 years ago that had a certain rate. If it's cut by, you know, 50%, there's a good chance that that's because they've taken these steps.
Yes. We've seen a report from Henry Ford Hospital just over the weekend that they now have assessed their reduction of deaths from heart attacks by 22%. That's a statistical estimate they can make based comparing their current experience to their prior experience.
Yeah. How many hospitals participated?
By our count, 3,103 hospitals have signed up and enrolled in the campaign. The average hospital in the United States is now part of this effort.
Mm-hmm. Was it with enthusiasm? Were they reluctant at first? How did they enter the program?
I imagine with 3,000 places involved, there's a wide range of degree of authenticity and enthusiasm. I'm sure some have just signed a piece of paper and done very little, but most of them seem to be doing something real. 86% are reporting mortality data directly to us. That's commitment. And IHI staff have been all over the country visiting hospitals, and they come back. I mean, their feet don't even touch the ground. They're so inspired by what they're seeing of hospitals and clinical staffs and managers digging in to get this job done. So I think something pretty authentic is going on here.
And how much do you plan to involve the consumer as well? Because some of the things that you recommend involve patients' families.
Absolutely. I don't think we've even begun to approach the limit of possibility in involving patients and families and loved ones in the care processes, giving them more power, more authority, more initiative, more knowledge, so they can actually help take care of themselves and help us take care of them. And so we can respect their values and honor what they want to do.
You've written about this in a personal way. You write that you need knee replacement surgery because of a botched knee operation 30 years ago. But you wonder, instead of helping you, will healthcare in the form of knee surgery, you know, kill you?
I'm putting off my knee surgery just as long as I possibly can. Hospitals are full of people trying hard to do the right thing, but they're also somewhat hazardous. And so doing anything unnecessary in healthcare is inviting risk. And so some sense of real caution about approaching invasive procedures in healthcare in general is called for, and I'm certainly doing that myself.
You write that in 1999, the Institute of Medicine had a report on hospital errors that concluded that up to 98,000 Americans die each year in hospitals, not, as we said, from the diseases that brought them, but from injuries caused by medical care. And you compared that to the statistics of, you know, being a mountain climber.
Yeah, I mean, you can change your denominator and get different numbers, but healthcare is easily as risky when you're an inpatient in a hospital as some serious mountain climbing can be. I mean, we know that about 3% of patients in hospitals get seriously injured during their admission by an error in their care, and a surprisingly large number, maybe as many as 1 in 200 or 1 in 300 patients actually die from the care they get. I think the best thing to do often is nothing, and we need to be much more cautious about approaching healthcare procedures. They carry risk.
Dr. Don Berwick, president of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, the organization announced today that its campaign to cut medical mistakes in hospitals has saved an estimated 122,000 lives since they started it in December of 2004. By the way, to see some of the steps that they recommend hospitals take, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Plans to lift what they call the veil of secrecy surrounding the priest sex abuse scandals by launching a new website that contains thousands of documents about priests accused, but not necessarily convicted, of sexual abuse. The group will launch the site tomorrow to coincide with the spring meeting of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops in Los Angeles, and it provides a detailed look inside the way the church has handled the priest sex abuse scandal through rarely seen church documents, court records, and media accounts. The website is called Bishop Accountability. Terry McKiernan has spent the last few years putting it together, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And again, the website doesn't really debut till tomorrow, but you've shown us much of the material. We've seen the site before, you know, it's launched. Thousands of pieces of material, letters from accused priests to their superiors, testimony from alleged victims, testimony from proven victims. Why did you decide to launch the site?
You know, we realized that there was an enormous amount of information out there that was hard to get at because it was scattered and, in many cases, substantially unknown.
And why did you personally decide to do this? Was anyone in your family directly affected by this?
No, you know, I was a parishioner at Paul Shanley's last parish. I got to know one of Paul Shanley's victims. That was probably the beginning of my involvement in the crisis.
Paul Shanley is the Boston area priest who's serving up to 15 years in prison after being convicted of child rape last year. We'll talk about some of the documents relating to Mr. Shanley, but as we said, it's a clearinghouse of documents on your website, and you're posting information about priests who haven't been convicted. You have any unease about that?
We are very careful only to aggregate and post information about accusations that have already been made. We're not in any way, shape, or form an investigative site. What we try to do instead is provide complete information about an accusation. So if an accusation has been denied, we present that information too. Our view is that the church ought to be much more careful about being open about all of these cases, because it's really in the church's interest and in the priest's interest to make sure that an unsubstantiated allegation is dealt with in an open way. That's the best way, in fact, of rehabilitating the priest.
We looked at some of the information about the priest we mentioned, Paul Shanley from here in the Boston area, who, again, is serving time in prison after being convicted of child rape. But here's an excerpt from a January 1990 letter that you have posted on your site. In it, a Boston Archdiocese official asks the San Bernardino Church in California to offer assistance to Shanley when he was on a one-year medical leave in Palm Springs. So here's a quote from that letter, again, from a superior to Paul Shanley. I can assure you that Father Shanley has no problem that would be a concern to your diocese. He has resigned from his parish on his own, and we shall place him in parish ministry when he returns. How shocking is that in the context of Shanley's story?
Well, it's especially shocking because the person who wrote that letter, now Bishop Banks of Green Bay, Wisconsin, actually had himself personally received a complaint from someone about Paul Shanley. So this is a rather vivid case. It's a good choice of document, actually. A rather vivid case of a senior chancery official who was subsequently rewarded by being given a bishopric of his own, a senior chancery official actually knowingly lying in a document.
What are some of the other documents that you have posted that would resonate in this way?
Unfortunately, we see many cases of priests being transferred very, very often between parishes and very often, in fact, between dioceses in order to get them into situations where they are not known. And the Boston documents are full of them. The Orange documents out in California are full of them. This was, unfortunately, a game plan. This is really the way the church for many, many years routinely handled priests in Shanley's condition.
Well, and I'm seeing, too, that you post, for instance, people who are disbelievers. Dorothy Rabinowitz of the Wall Street Journal, you post one of her articles about a priest that she's very defensive about.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think it's a very interesting article, and it deserves to be read. Now, our role in the crisis is to provide, as best we can, all the information. And her analysis is very interesting in some ways. She's very interested in the role of lawyers in all of this. Mm-hmm. She's also very interested in the role of therapists in all of this.
What do you say to Catholics who say, look, we've dealt with this in a very public way, we need to move on, and this website will not let the Catholic Church move on?
Well, of course, we disagree, but respectfully so, really. I mean, we do understand that it is difficult to maintain your faith and focus on things like this. We face that difficulty every day. But I would say, and I think, oddly enough, a lot of priests would agree with me, that what the bishops have done is to load the onus entirely on the priests and give themselves a free pass. Just 2 days ago, 4 years ago, when the bishops arrived in Dallas for their meeting, the Dallas Morning News published an expose that went to many, many pages in the local paper, showing that two-thirds of the bishops had themselves been responsible for doing exactly the thing that you just mentioned, transferring a priest they knew to be guilty into another situation where he could continue to abuse. The bishops have remained relatively untouched in all of this, and I would probably name that as the chief reason I would say we can't move on. The bishops are trying to move on, but unfortunately the same men who were doing this all along managerially are still doing it.
And how would you characterize yourself? Are you a Catholic, a fallen Catholic because of the crisis?
I'm a practicing Catholic. It's not easy to do that these days, but I still go to Mass. And if anything, oddly enough, I think probably the crisis has deepened my faith because it's required me really to examine it in a way that I hadn't before. That said, not a day passes that I don't think of the victims who are not able to do the thing that I have the luxury of doing, who simply can't even go into a church, who's, I know a woman in Wichita, Kansas, whose son committed suicide after being abused. And this is a very, very devout woman from a devout family. And she can't even go into a church anymore. When I think of that kind of a question, what I do is think of how hard it is for the people who are more nearly struck by this to cope with it.
Well, this story obviously has had an impact on you. Is it a story that's in the website?
Sure. You know, your listeners could go to the database of accused priests, which is one of the links on the new site premiering tomorrow. And if they click that link, the first option they have is to view by name, and they can type the name Larson, L-A-R-S-O-N.
That's the name of the priest?
Name of the priest, and hit view.
Now, this is a perfect example. You say, a young boy committed suicide. Was the priest convicted?
The priest ultimately was convicted, but the story is even more amazing and horrible than that. There are actually five known suicide victims among his sexual abuse victims. This is a man who just cut a swath through a farm community.
And where is he now?
That's a good question. He is out of jail. He's been released after serving his time. And obviously a lot of people think that he's a danger to society, but he's out here now.
Terry McKiernan, launching a website called bishopaccountability.org. It presents thousands of documents related to the Catholic Church abuse scandal. The website will be launched tomorrow. Terry, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Forecasts for another powerful and active hurricane season, combined with concerns about terrorist attacks worldwide, are leading a growing number of vacationers to take out travel insurance policies. The number of policies issued has tripled this year compared to 2001, with a third of all vacationers now buying some form of travel insurance. Khalil Sakakini is editor of GoTravelUpdates.com. He joins us on the line with more on this. And we understand, Khalil, this is a hot topic.
It's a very hot topic. It's kind of like the old American Express ad, do you dare leave home without it? I would say before 9/11, you probably could have left home without travel insurance. Today, I would say absolutely not.
Oh, really? No. So you're recommending this? You don't think this is just a trendy thing that people are, you know, with false comfort?
No. I mean, I just came back from Nicaragua, for example. It's absolutely a lovely country, just emerging, opening itself up. I bought insurance not because I had any concerns about it, but because I do it now almost as a matter of fact. It's just rote for me to do that. It's inexpensive. Travel is a tremendously big investment, a lot of money tied up, a lot of hopes, a lot of dreams, and anything can happen, from not even terrorist-related issues or hurricane-related issues. God forbid somebody could die in the family and you've paid maybe $5,000 on a cruise, and you're about to leave in 3 days, and you can't because of the death in the family, that money is lost without some sort of coverage.
Huh.
And more importantly, maybe the whole issue of medical coverage
right.
and the emergency evacuation.
Let's talk about that. When I did, you know, a couple of big trips, I purchased at least one of those policies
sure.
because, well, I was going to be in an area where I knew I'd have to be medevaced out.
It's a very horrifying experience. I remember also being in Belize when we were doing some caving, and we had to crawl over these horrible boulders, and I just looked, and I saw one woman come perilously close to snapping a leg, and I said, "Dear God, only way out of here would be a helicopter." If you have a whole package, which is basically trip cancellation, trip interruption insurance, that has to include the medical component, which then covers repatriation of remains, not to be gruesome about it, but evacuation and plus movement to medical coverage.
Tell us more about the evacuation. I know there are specific companies that do medical evacuation. I'm thinking of MedJet Assist.
Well, yeah. I mean, I probably would not opt for MedJet because I don't think its policies are quite as comprehensive. I don't know exactly what they offer in terms of, let's say, trip cancellation or trip interruption or baggage recovery or baggage tracking or concierge services. So they may be a one-themed company.
In fact, we read that MedJet Assist charges $75 for 7 days of coverage, and they provide a flying ambulance evacuation from where you are back to your home city in the U.S. So there are some companies that just specifically do that, but you're saying you can get policies that are broader than that?
I think any policy that covers trip cancellation or trip interruption will also cover evacuation and medical services. So I think you need to buy that kind of comprehensive umbrella policy.
Well, and tell us, how much do these cost generally? Can you give us an equation?
Yeah. In my recent trip, because I did not need to have the cost of my actual travel covered for other reasons, I just bought some medical insurance. And that cost, I think it was $50 for 6 days for two people. And that covered, I think it was $100,000. In fact, I'm looking at the policy now. It's $100,000 for emergency evacuation, $100,000 medical services, $500 for dental. And that covered me from the day I left to the day I returned. I gave them the dates. And that cost, I think, about $50 for 5 or 6 days. Mm. It's all age sensitive, to some extent destination sensitive. And it also is a function of the cost of the trip, too.
And we understand the pricing is based on that, as well as your age, how long you're going to be traveling,
right.
the type of trip. So it's as most insurance policies are, it would take in other things as well.
Yeah.
There's a comparative website. It's called InsureMyTrip.com. Do you recommend that?
I love InsureMyTrip.com. I really do. I just think that they have been they're very thoughtful, and they are very good because they also have a very receptive and very caring call center. So when I bought the insurance, I got the immediate thank you from the president of the company, of course, and I called with a question, and they were very responsive. And they just know their stuff. So it's primarily online, and they may not have all the bells and whistles that some companies do.
Khalil Sakakini, a sign of the times, perhaps, to pack along with your, you know, swim trunks.
And your toothbrush.
Your insurance policy. Khalil, editor of GoTravelUpdates.com, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. thoughts, poet Donald Hall said of his new job. Today, Hall was named America's Poet Laureate by the Library of Congress. The role is a largely ceremonial one with few specific duties to take him away from the white clapboard farmhouse in New Hampshire where his family's lived for generations. But still, it's a pretty big deal. Donald Hall is especially known for his two collections, Without and The Painted Bed, in which he wrote about his wife, the late poet Jane Kenyon, their life together, and her death from leukemia in 1995. A recent memoir, The Best Day, The Worst Day, records that grief in prose. Hall is also known for his blunt defense of the First Amendment, and he joins us from New Hampshire Public Radio to talk about all of this. Donald Hall, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
A terrible miscellany of thought. What do you mean by that?
Oh, I'm asked to come up with something to promote the distribution of poetry, and I have all sorts of thoughts, but they keep moving around on me. I wrote a letter to one friend asking for his advice, and he sent me back 85 different suggestions. That bewilders me also.
Right. You were quoted as saying you feel a bit frantic. Why? What do you think is expected of you?
I'm feeling frantic right now because of the telephone is ringing off the hook.
Right.
I had a phone call this morning from somebody I haven't seen since the eighth grade. And yesterday it was telephone interviews with the New York Times and the Washington Post and so on.
Sure.
So I live a quiet life normally, silence and solitude.
Do you see this new job as, a bully pulpit for poetry?
Yes, that's what it's supposed to be, and some laureates have been able to do great things. And I'm going to write letters to some of them and ask them for their advice. I really don't know much about what kind of resource I have in Washington when I go there.
Well, and you've had a little experience. We were reminded that you were a member of the Advisory Council of the National Endowment for the Arts during the administration of the first President Bush. And
right.
You referred to those that you thought were interfering with the arts grants as bullies and art bashers. Now, do you think that kinds of language will come from your new pulpit?
I don't know if it'll be so negative. I hope it doesn't have the occasion of that negativity.
Yeah. Well, let me talk about your work, which has been compared to Frost. By the way, how do you feel about that? You're said to be Frostian.
Yes, I don't write like him at all. I don't make the same kind of sounds he makes. But I do have some of the same material, the rural life many years later, and the landscape of New Hampshire. So there is a connection in theme, I suppose, but not at all in language or in sound.
Yeah. What do you mean by sound, by the way? I would love to hear one of your poems, and maybe in so doing you could explain that to us.
The sound of poetry is the most important thing for me. It makes a kind of aesthetic whole of the poem. The poem exists to be beautiful, and in its beauty it does transmit feeling. And I think the feeling comes through by sound as well as by imagery. But for me, sound comes first.
Well, Houghton Mifflin has just published a new collection of your work. It's called White Apples and the Taste of Stone, Selected Poems from 1946 to 2006. Perhaps if you could read something from that and we could talk about the sound of it.
Sure. Yeah. I'll read the poem from which I took the title.
Okay.
It's called White Apples. Mm-hmm. When my father had been dead a week, I woke with his voice in my ear. I sat up in bed and held my breath and stared at the pale closed door. White apples and the taste of stone. If he called again, I would put on my coat and galoshes. That's it. That's the whole thing. It's a tiny little poem.
Yes, and my heart is just, it's powerful.
Sound is all sorts of things, including sort of obvious ones. The first line ends a week, and the second line is I woke, a week, I woke.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously a repetition there. I wrote this poem, I began this poem about 2 weeks after my father died when I was 27, but I didn't really finish it for about 17 years because at the beginning all I had was the plot, the action, which is stated in fairly flat and commonplace terms. But one day I had been looking at this poem and realizing it didn't work. I was walking along the lawn of the house where I lived at that time, and this line came into my head, white apples and the taste of stone, and I knew it belonged in this poem.
What do you mean by it?
I mean by it to encapsulate the feeling of the desolation and emptiness and coldness that this story involves the death of my father, and be dreaming that I hear him knocking on the front door in the snow. The line simply brought poetry to this short few verse poem in a way that held the feeling and directed the feeling of the poem. White apples and a taste of stone. S-T, taste, S-T, stone. Also, taste and stone are both long vowels. White is a long vowel. And it makes a rather slow line. As for where it came from, I have a funny story about that. Once I was doing an interview with Bill Moyers, and he brought up this poem and asked me about this line. And I said I knew it was right, but I couldn't explain it to him. And he said it made him think of funerary ornaments. Well, that's why not? But the strange thing is that when I was walking across the lawn at that house, I was looking past the backyard at a cemetery. We backed right up to a cemetery where there were things like stone apples carved into granite. And I presume that that is how I happened to have that line come in my head, but I was not aware of it at all at the time.
Huh.
It just felt appropriate, it felt right, and I trusted it.
Yeah. And without it, it's really just telling someone about a dream.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, two collections of poems and a memoir about your life with and without Jane Kenyon. Because of this, you become known as sort of a poet of grief.
Yes, I have been earlier a poet of elegy a lot. I wrote about my grandfather, his death, in my first book. And there, of course, have been other deaths and losses all along. But it is as if I were waiting for something truly terrible to happen to be able to write about it. And when Janie died at 47, I couldn't keep from my desk. Every day I wrote. And I spent a lot of time writing a series of letters to her. There were things that happened that I needed to tell her. I couldn't tell her, not in reality. But I wrote these poems in the form of letters where I could jump from one subject to another, as one does in a letter. And it really saved my life that first year.
And now a new chapter to your life. And I'm just wondering, Donald Hall, in about the minute we have left, what do you think you'll write about now? Is there something forming because of this new journey you're embarking on?
I feel no impulses toward poetry about the poetry chair. Maybe I will. Who knows? And then when I'm in Washington, I will go to museums, which I love to do, to look at sculpture and at painting. And something might well come out of that.
You're going to Washington in an interesting time in our country.
Indeed, yes.
Thoughts about that?
Well, I have had thoughts about my feelings about the current government and how I don't want anybody to think I'm working for the administration.
There was a time in recent memory where poets made a statement by not attending, I believe it was a luncheon, with the First Lady.
Yes.
Do you think you'll get involved in the politics of the city?
I doubt it, because other poet laureates have not done.
And do you think it'll be inappropriate? I mean,
I would take part in political protests at any time, whether I'm a poet at the Library of Congress or not.
Donald Hall was named America's new poet laureate today. His newest book is White Apples and the Taste of Stone, Selected Poems from 1946 to 2006. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. He's been speaking to us from New Hampshire. And New England is going to miss you for a little while, but best of luck to you.
Thank you. I'll be coming back a good bit.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.